You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Jessica Hopkins, toku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te Wire, mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rapa Wednesday. I'm your host, Jessica, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producer Troy. Ewhai Akine coming up on the show. First up, we have Auckland University Students Association President Alan Shaker in the studio for our monthly catch-up. Then for our weekly interview, I spoke to ACT Party MP Karen Chua about the government's increase to the minimum wage and Chris Hipkins' recent policy purge, which included halting hate speech legislation. I also talked to independent researcher Byron Clark about his new book, Fear, New Zealand's Hostile Underworld of Extremists, which has come out today, and why we should be watchful and fearful of the far right's potential impact on politics. Troy, what have you got for the Green Desk today?
Today I spoke to University of Canterbury Professor John Hopkins about what a national state of emergency means for Aotearoa and the impact this response can have.
Kia ora whakaaro, I would love to hear your thoughts on any of our pieces today. So get in touch, tuku pā tuhi mai, text us on 5395 or wire mai rane, give us a call in the studio on 309 3879. Ka owa e wariwari e ahe ana koutou, te whakarongo ki ene kōrero, anohi pakihere roki roki mā runga i te pai tuku tuku o irirangi pōpō, me haere ki 95BFM, ira karikom. And as always, catch all of our stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
The Wire.
First up today, we are joined in the studio by AUSA President Alan Shaker. First of all, do you mind just introducing yourself to our listeners and kind of your background with AUSA?
Oh, sure thing, Jess. Kia ora tātou. My name is Alan Shaker. As Jess mentioned, I have the privilege of being the AUSA president for this year. Prior to this role, I was the education vice president for 2 years on the executive, so I've got a bit of experience with AUSA. In terms of my university life, I'm a fifth-year student studying a Bachelor of Arts and a Bachelor of Science.
Can you tell us, speaking of the flooding and the cyclone, if students are needing support right now, where can they go to get some support from AUSA?
Look, obviously we send our hearts out to the students affected. We've had students contact us, and at the moment we're directing our students to the support services available by the university. So that's campus care and the services provided by campus life. We are nearing semester one, so our hardship grants will be opening in semester one, and students will be able to apply for that. But at the moment we're directing our students to the national guidance given and also the university support services available.
O week is now approaching. No doubt student safety is going to be a priority for you. So can you tell us a little bit about any initiatives you have planned to address some of these safety concerns during O week?
Yeah, for sure. Look, this year we've partnered with Auckland Council and Red Frogs to run a harm prevention project in the Auckland CBD, and it's appropriately called Safe Zones. Because, look, as you mentioned, we want students to have a good time during O week, but for us, paramount is safety. So we're setting up sites across the CBD to offer medical assistance, guidance, supervision, and all without judgment. So these we'll have two sites set up, one in the Alan Melville Centre and the other at Pocket Park on K Road. And they'll be from about 10 p.m. on the Thursday, 2nd of March, Friday, 3rd of March, and also Saturday, 4th of March.
And will these be available just to students, or is it any sort of young people that might be in town?
It's for any young people that might be in town. So, like I said, obviously we know a lot of students will be out in town and we want to keep them safe, but it's also a safe space for many other people in town.
And you've recently shared some warnings about aggressive recruitment on campus. Can you tell us a little bit about what aggressive recruitment is and how students can recognise it?
Yeah, for sure. So we published a statement a couple of weeks ago in regards to this. You know, we've had a couple of students or a handful of students approach us about them feeling uncomfortable with some recruitment tactics. There's a specific group on campus at the moment that is looking to target vulnerable students, young females or people who are by themselves, and try to isolate them away from their friends and family. So at the moment, all we're doing is spreading awareness and letting students know to be aware of this. But we're also working with the university and security in terms of being more vigilant about this group on campus.
Yeah, and do we know any more information about what students should do if they're approached by these groups, or if any students may think that they actually might be involved in something like this, where they can go to get support?
Look, obviously AUSA is always here to support those students. I think that the key thing to remember is a lot of these students feel uncomfortable leaving the situation. So like I said, we are raising awareness in terms of how to navigate that tricky situation. And there's also a university webpage that's been set up in terms of where to access support from the university specifically.
And what has the university's response been so far? Can you tell us a little bit about what AUSA and the university are doing to address this issue heading into OWEC?
Obviously, heading into OWEC is going to be a big concern for us because there's going to be a lot of students on campus. So we've had meetings with campus life and the university team, and since then we've seen security be a bit more vigilant in terms of approaching these groups on campus. But like I said, the biggest thing for us is raising awareness, and I think the university at the moment is going to be working on some comms to let students know about this situation.
Depending on sort of what happens with our national state of emergency, can you tell us a bit about what AUSA has planned for OWEC and some of the events and celebrations that might be coming up?
Yeah, for sure. Look, we've got an awesome OWEC planned this year. Starting from the 27th of February, we are shutting down Alfred Street, and we're bringing back orientation back to its rightful home, which is Alfred Street. And our plan is to put a festival like no other. So we're transforming the street into a stage. There's going to be live music, performances, the UOA Clubs Expo. There's going to be food trucks, arcade zones, and of course, what students love, a lot of freebies. So look, we're really, really excited for what's going to happen in the orientation festival. And then obviously on Wednesday night, we round off the OWEC festival with our official concert for orientation, rightly named Alfred's. So we've decided to bring the concert back home on Alfred Street, where students will be. So from 4 p.m. on Wednesday, we'll have Alfred's, a street party happening on Alfred Street. And from 4 p.m, we'll have acts like Maroki, Wax Mustang, Georgia Lines, Messiah, No Cigar, Witters, Juju Lips, and Kataya Youngie Twins. And of course, the best thing for students is that it's free. You don't need a ticket. And again, it's just an amazing event, and I'm so excited to see it happen. And obviously, I'd like to give a massive shout out to the AUSA events team for putting this together. It's been months and months and months of planning, but also to our sponsors, Red Bull, Liars, and JBL New Zealand.
I could be wrong, but is this sort of our first OWEC back at the University of Auckland since COVID? So that must be really exciting.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, I've been on the executive for 3 years now, and I haven't had a normal OWEC. So on a personal note, I'm quite excited for this. But most importantly, I'm excited for the students. I'm excited to see students falling out the street, enjoying themselves. And look, people come here for a degree, but they also come here for an experience.
All right. Well, thank you so much for chatting with us today, Alan. And we'll catch you next month for some more updates from AUSA.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Karen Chaw.
This week I spoke to Karen about Chris Hipkins' decision to increase the minimum wage, as well as his decision to refer over their hate speech legislation to the Law Commission. Here is that interview now. The Prime Minister announced that the minimum wage would be increasing by $1.50 to $22.70 an hour from April 1st. What do you think about this decision?
Yeah, so ACT has come out and said that we really don't agree with the decision that's been made on that rise. And there's a couple of reasons. I mean, we've got 30% of businesses that are saying they aren't sure if they'll survive the next 12 months. We've been through quite a lot of catastrophes over the last couple of years with COVID and now the flooding up in Auckland and a whole lot of other legislation that's gone through that affects small to medium businesses the most. We're talking about, you know, all the other policies that they've brought in with extra sick leave and holiday pay and all those other things added on top. And I just think at a time where businesses are struggling the most, that this must have been a blow to them.
Hipkins has said that the increase is in line with inflation and that the impact on inflation would be negligible. Do you think that this 7% increase will help families or those on lower incomes with the rising cost of living?
Well, if you actually have a look, only 7% of workers are on minimum wage, and only 1.5% of those on minimum wage have dependent children in their household. This is a lot of minimum wage workers are part-time workers or students looking for work while they're studying or at university. So I think, you know, if we want to help those that are struggling the most, we have things in place right now that could help them, like working for families, tax credits, and many other policies that are in place at the moment. So I just think we need to have a real hard look at who this is hurting the most. And it's going to be hurting the small businesses, and it's going to be hurting students that just want a chance to get a job.
The National Party has said that they would support an increase in the minimum wage, but just not as much of an increase. Is this something that ACT could get on board with as well?
Yeah, see, $1.50 is a huge rise. And I think most businesses were expecting a rise in the minimum wage, but not that much of a rise. Businesses usually plan a year ahead. They look at their expenses and their overheads and what their staff are going to cost them. And $1.50 an hour rise with only a couple of months' notice is quite harmful. So I think they were expecting a rise. It just wasn't as high as this. And I think we should really be giving small to medium businesses a bit of a break. And ACT has called on a 3-year sort of moratorium on minimum wage rises for that reason. Just let good businesses get back on their feet. Let tourism come back and let businesses have a chance to thrive.
So then what would the ACT Party do instead to help those struggling with the cost of living?
Yeah, so there's a few things in place at the moment. Like I said, there's working for families, tax credits and other policies. But there's also, we need to look at, there needs to be a bit of give and take. It can't just be up to businesses to subsidise government decisions. We can look at having tax cuts so that people keep more in their pocket. And ACT has policies around that, changing it to 2 tax rates. Making sure that, and this would give the average New Zealander an extra $1,200 in their pocket to decide what to do with. So I think governments need to take some of the burden and not just push this burden onto business owners.
The next topic I wanted to ask you about was the recent halt of the government's proposed amendment that would have expanded protection from incitement under the Human Rights Act to religious groups. And they've instead referred it to the Law Commission. And this is part of Hipkins' policy purge to focus more on what he's calling bread and butter issues. So what was your reaction to this particular policy being scrapped?
I think there'll be lots of people out there that are relieved that this policy actually hasn't been scrapped. It's just the can's been kicked down the road for another day. And I'm not quite sure what the Law Commission is going to say any different to what is being said right now. So I think they're just kicking the can down the road. It's a bit too hard to debate this issue right now with an election coming up, and guarantee you that if the Labor government got back into power at the next election, that this would be back on the agenda.
Freedom of expression is a fundamental human right, but there are other rights that are important as well, such as the right to non-discrimination. Do you recognise that there are groups that are vulnerable to hatred and discrimination in Aotearoa, and what would ACT do about this?
Yeah, you are right. Freedom of expression is one of the most important values our society has. And ACT doesn't believe that you should be punished for having an opinion. And you know, there are already hate speech laws in place right now that protect against dangerous speech and inciting harm. But I just feel that the words that they're using and the way that they're trying to do this will actually be more harmful than helpful. Threatening to incite violence should be illegal, but But using words subjective like offensive or insulting should never be used to prosecute offences. We should be able to question things. I mean, there's been many things within religion that we may not agree with, and Brian Tamaki would be one of them. I don't necessarily agree with some of the stuff that he's been saying, and I feel we do have a right to question what's been said, and sometimes ridicule what's been said because it's ridiculous, and we shouldn't be open to prosecution for that.
Right, so what current protections are in place and why do you believe that these are enough as they currently are?
We already can't incite violence and we can't incite, make people feel, threaten people to the point where they feel unsafe. That's there. This is more around offensive or insulting words, and who decides what's offensive and what's insulting, and is this going to create a space in this country where people are too scared to speak up in case they might be breaking the law, and we may suppress people's speech to the point where it goes underground, and that could cause even more problems.
But at the same time, there are people that are being silenced and are afraid to speak up about some of the hatred and discrimination they're facing. So what would you propose for those people that are affected by this in their day-to-day lives? For example, those who were affected by the Christchurch mosque attacks in 2019 and the ongoing abuse Muslim New Zealanders face. So what would you do to address this issue?
Yes, I understand that. And with freedom of speech comes the consequences of that speech, right? Nobody has to stand and tolerate what somebody's saying to them. You don't have to agree with them, and you can push back on what they're saying. There are consequences to the words we use, and if we do insult someone or offend someone, that person has the right to push back. And you see it within society. When people do say offensive stuff, the pushback from society is very, very strong. And I feel it should not be you should not be prosecuted for this kind of speech. And there's no way that this law would have stopped what happened on that day with the mosque attacks. But I do feel for people that do have these offensive words coming their way. But is it really a prosecution? Is it really an offence that you should be prosecuted for?
Hipkins is calling for cross-party support on acting on the recommendations that they received and expanding this legislation. Is there any way that the ACT Party would be on board with any amendments to hate speech legislation or any other sort of actions that could be taken to address some of the abuse that's being faced by certain communities in our country?
Yeah, that's the good thing about Parliament, right? Ideas get brought forward and the Labor Party can bring forward some ideas, and when we see them and we read through them, that's when we can kind of make comment or decide on whether we would support or not support something. I really am uncomfortable with commenting on a hypothetical because who knows what will be put up.
Would there be a certain threshold that, you know, your party would need to have in place? For example, you've mentioned opinions, freedom of opinion expression, those things you'd like to see protected. But for example, you know, calling for mass genocide of a particular group, is there any way that legislation could be in place to protect against those kind of things from being accepted online?
See, that sort of thing would already fall under hate speech. Calling for mass genocide already falls under hate speech. That's inciting violence and hatred, and that already falls under the current laws of protection.
I guess then some people would argue that our current laws then maybe aren't working because people are able to get away with these things. So what would your sort of proposal then be to address that?
Well, if that's the case and people are getting away with inciting hatred and violence of that kind, we need to be enforcing the current laws that are in place. There's no point in having a law if it's not being enforced. So I would say that I would fully back that being enforced.
Well, that was all the questions that I had, unless there was anything else you wanted to add.
Oh, no, that's pretty much all I had to say on that. I mean, we've had this discussion in Labor saying that on one hand, almost no one would be prosecuted under this new proposal. But, you know, if you're going to have this kind of religious protection for religious groups, wouldn't you want this to be enforced? You kind of can't have it both ways. You can't say almost no one will be prosecuted under this law, but on the other hand, it will protect groups. So I think that's the same issue we were just talking about, making sure we're enforcing the current laws as they are.
That was our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Karen Chaw.
And we'll be back right after a short break. You're tuned into The Wire. Let us know your thoughts on any of our pieces today. Text in on 5395.
What's a seven-letter word for Street Fighter?
No idea. I know that tonight at Ponsonby Social Club there's...
Boteco Beats with Enrique Morales and guests, with support from Bobby Brazuca.
And tomorrow...
A live tribute to the internet, followed by DJs Carlotta and Kirsty Sutherland.
Same old Ponsonby Social Club, 152 Ponsonby Road.
It's music. We played it first. Broadcast to the world and podcast to your device on 95bfm.com.
And it is odd for somebody to pay you $100 for a photo of your feet. That is not normal behaviour.
The Wire.
Since the Christchurch mosque attacks in 2019, the pandemic and the conspiracy theories and anti-government sentiment that followed in response, there has been increased scrutiny and media coverage of the extreme right in Aotearoa. In his new book, Fear, New Zealand's Hostile Underworld of Extremists, independent researcher Byron Clark makes sense of the alt-right influence in Aotearoa, identifies the main perpetrators, and looks at why we are susceptible to misinformation, conspiracy theory, and fear-mongering. I spoke to Clark about why we should be watchful and fearful of the far-right's growing influence. Here is that interview. In your book, you've stated that Aotearoa has one of the highest concentrations of alt-right groups compared with other nations. So can you tell us, firstly, what characterises an alt-right group or an alt-right extremist and how we got to this point in Aotearoa?
Yes, I'm not sure exactly why we have such a higher concentration compared to some other countries. That statistic comes from an organisation called the Institute for Strategic Dialogue, who prepared some research for the counter-terrorism hui's that have been held, you know, following the terror attack in Christchurch. The number of groups here is, you know, perhaps not particularly high, but I think because we're a small country, people can easily make those connections and communicate with each other. So one thing that I found in my research is while there's different groups that don't always agree on everything and, you know, have a fair bit of infighting, they are in the same social media groups on Telegram or Facebook and often attending the same protests. So I think being a small country has given these groups an opportunity to, you know, network a bit with each other and influence each other, and perhaps that's a reason why, you know, why it's a bit more prevalent here than it is in larger countries.
I'm sort of interested in talking about the word underworld that you use in your book title, and you talk about how often the far-right conspiracy scene, they grow in the dark sort of corners of the internet, but we're seeing sort of their ideologies have more and more prominence and have more and more real-world effects. I mean, my first week at university, you mentioned a group on campus at the University of Auckland who called themselves the European Students Association, and I came in touch with them my first week on campus. You know, I saw them on campus. So where are these groups kind of originating from, and how has it now spread to sort of create real-world consequences?
So a lot of it is originating online with people communicating, you know, places like 4chan, 8chan, these days very much with Telegram groups. And these may be people who are quite isolated to begin with, but then online they find this community, and that might be based around, you know, a particular conspiracy theory, and then might spread to other conspiracy theories, or it might be around, you know, actually, you know, having a racist worldview or a misogynistic worldview, and so on. And yeah, what we've seen really since about 2017 is these people who are meeting up online in these forums and things, deciding, hey, we need to do something offline, you know, make our presence shown. And that's where you get things like the European Students Association and Western Guard, which was a sort of false start for far-right groups. They tried to, you know, present themselves as a bit bigger than they were and have a presence there. So we had a few small groups like that in 2017, and then we had the Dominion movement was probably the more longer-lasting of those, but that, of course, went into hiatus right after the Christchurch mosque shooting. And then we've had, you know, another group, Action Zealandia, emerge from the remnants of the Dominion movement. But then we've had all these other movements that aren't necessarily directly related to that, particularly with the pandemic, people spending a lot of time online, going down these conspiracy rabbit holes, and then going offline when they meet up with these people at the various protests or the roadshow tour that Counterspin was doing or the other public meetings and things that are being held around the place.
The Prime Minister recently halted their proposed amendments, a proposed amendment that would have extended protection from incitement of hatred under the Human Rights Act to religious groups, instead referring it to the Law Commission. And since you mentioned the 2019 Christchurch mosque attacks, there's been calls for hate speech laws to be expanded. But this has seen a lot of criticism. What has your reaction sort of been to the debate surrounding hate speech recently?
Mostly I found the debate quite frustrating because there's a lot of, I guess, what you'd call straw man arguments, and people are saying things like, we can't allow the government to, you know, criminalise criticising religion, or we can't allow the government to, you know, make laws stopping you from offending people. Whereas if you actually look at the legislation, it's nothing like that at all. It's merely expanding the legislation we've had on the books since 1993 around racial groups and ethnic groups to include religious groups. So the law that we've had for 30 years has only been used once, quite recently, against a man who uploaded a video to YouTube where he brandished a gun and called for a genocide of Māori, and he got 3 months home detention. So what the bar is for inciting racial hatred or racial disharmony seems to be calling for genocide with a weapon. And if you do that, you might, you know, have to stay at home with an ankle bracelet for 3 months. That's a very far cry from, you know, the government bringing in blasphemy laws, which is one thing I've heard this described as, or, you know, the government making it a crime to criticise religion or anything like that. I think it would be good if we could have a debate with a real sober analysis of what the laws actually are, what the bar is for incitement, and how the laws would actually be used, instead of, you know, creating the straw man of new blasphemy laws or outlawing offending people, which is just not what any of the proposed changes are.
To what extent do you think the far-right movement and that their inciting rhetoric has influenced this debate?
I think it's definitely had some influence. I think it's not just coming from them. It's coming as well from a more kind of libertarian right-wing view on, you know, freedom of speech, and I think we're seeing that a little bit from, like, the ACT Party, for example. But a lot of the rhetoric is coming from these smaller parties outside Parliament. And one thing that I think is important to remember is that just because a party's outside Parliament doesn't mean they can't have an influence on politics. Certainly in an election year, politicians who are in Parliament are going to be looking at, you know, what parties are polling at sort of 1 or 2% and thinking about how they can capture that section of the electorate for themselves. So that's why you get, as I write about in the book, parties adopting the disinformation campaign against the UN Migration Compact in 2018. And I think we're seeing a similar thing with the so-called hate speech legislation, where a party like ACT could look at what's being said on the fringe and think, well, there are some votes to be won in, calling for, and ACT is calling not just for not passing new hate speech legislation, but actually calling for the repeal of the part of the Human Rights Act that outlaws inciting racial disharmony. And I think there's definitely a bit of influence from groups further to the right that are promoting that, because that law has been on the books for 30 years and ACT wasn't talking about it until the last couple of years.
And in your book, you've encouraged people to be sort of watchful and fearful of the far right's potential influence on politics. How can we prevent this sort of ideology from gaining further momentum in politics in Aotearoa?
I think for the general population, it's being, having some more media literacy and some being able to think critically about, what you read, not just the misinformation and disinformation, but, be critical about what you see politicians saying and think to yourself, why are they saying this? Whose votes are they trying to win with this? And, what attitudes are they trying to stir up in the electorate to benefit them? I think there's also an important role for journalism to be, calling out this stuff. To go back to the UN Migration Compact example, the National Party had a petition against that on their website, which they pulled, almost immediately after the Christchurch shooting, when it was revealed that the shooter had "Here's Your Migration Compact" written on one of his guns. And there was, a fair bit of criticism from the media after that, and former press secretary resigned from his job at the party. But there could have been more of a pushback, before the shooting, because even before that atrocity, it wasn't unknown that this campaign had been started by far-right groups in Europe. And I think we could be more watchful of things like that going forward, when we start to see, disinformation campaigns and so forth, and when we then see more mainstream politicians adopting those, journalists can be looking at, where these ideas came from and how they made their way to mainstream politics, and publishing about that, letting the public know.
You mentioned in your book that by speaking out about this, politicians, journalists and researchers like yourself have become targets of the alt-right. So what made you want to address this issue despite sort of the safety risks of speaking out publicly?
Well, I was very much inspired to start doing this after the mosque shooting happened. I'd started following the alt-right a little bit before that, just seeing what was happening overseas with the rise of the far-right in Europe after the 2015 refugee crisis, the rise of the alt-right online after Gamergate and the 2016 Trump campaign in the US, and all these things I was watching. And I started to watch the groups here, that very small groups at that point, and the Facebook pages and things that they'd run. And then when the shooting happened in Christchurch, I felt that I know a lot about this movement, and I've been following this, and it's time to start communicating that information publicly so more people can be aware and more people can know about that. And that's from there I started a YouTube channel and later some freelance writing and ultimately now this book. And I think the reason I do it despite the danger is that there's just a real importance to be aware of what's happening and be aware of what they're doing. And I think as well, while I get a lot of harassment and criticism and things from the far right, the fact that I'm a Pākehā male means that I am subject to less of this harassment than women in this space or people of colour in this space, particularly migrants, Indigenous people, Muslims, and so forth. So, I've got a bit of privilege there that I think actually protects me from some of the worst of the harassment from the far right. And I think it's important for people who do have that privilege to be some of the ones speaking out about this.
Touching on speaking out about this, I think a lot of people have people in their lives that may have kind of been drawn in by conspiracy theories or
misinformed, you know. I've had not just older people, but particularly, you know, older people in my life kind of saying things as if they are fact and not realising that this is actually sort of formed by this alt-right rhetoric. So do you have any sort of advice or anything that people could do to kind of help pull those people out of that rabbit hole, or is there anything you can do? Sort of, how do we sort of address individuals in our lives?
The evidence shows that it's pretty difficult to pull someone out of that rabbit hole. It's comparable actually to someone leaving a cult. They can really only leave that space when they're ready to themselves, and then people can help them out. If it's just someone who's, you know, read an article and thought it was true and it wasn't, and you can show them that it wasn't, then, you know, in some cases that might be enough. But for people who have really, really got committed to this sort of alternative reality, that's a much harder task. What's important, though, is the strength of the relationship you have with that person. Sometimes people think they might be able to, you know, pull someone out of that space by, you know, showing them my YouTube videos or something like that. And I think in very few cases would that work, because I'm just a stranger on the internet to these people. But if there's, you know, a close friend or a family member who actually has a strong relationship with them, that's much more likely to help them get out of there. So while I've heard some people who have, you know, cut off relationships with people who have gone really far down the rabbit hole, and, you know, I certainly aren't going to tell people not to do that if that's what they need to do for their own well-being or their own safety. But I think when people have still got a relationship there, that's when you've got something that you can use to, you know, help pull someone back to reality.
And if people want to learn more about this topic, where can they get a copy of your book, and what can they expect to read when they get your book?
You should be able to get the book anywhere good books are sold. It's in all the major bookstores, and probably most of the independent ones as well. I think what you can expect really is a brief history of the alternative right over the last half a decade, but also, you know, digging a bit deeper into history and looking at some of the origins of, you know, some of these ideas around like white supremacy and Islamophobia and so on. It doesn't necessarily offer a fix to this. I wish I could, you know, lay out a plan for how we fix this problem. But I think it'll, if you're reading it, you know, give you that information you need to really start, you know, working to do your part, whether that's, yeah, helping a friend or family member who's down these rabbit holes, or working on some of the other issues around this that are leading to us being in this situation politically right now.
And that was independent researcher Byron Clark on his new book, all about alt-right-wing extremism in Aotearoa.
Trees, mountains, a curious kittadu.
It's time for the Green Desk on 95 BFM.
For the third time in history, a national state of emergency has been declared in New Zealand. Cyclone Gabrielle has devastated parts of the country, which instigated the government to enact this emergency state and respond accordingly. Today I spoke with Canterbury University Professor John Hopkins about what a national state of emergency declaration means and how long this might last, and whether we should anticipate future emergencies that could be responded to with the same action. Just for our listeners who may not understand what a national state of emergency means, can you please explain what it is and what this means for Aotearoa?
Yes, the national state of emergency is a rare thing. It's only been used twice in the past, once for Canterbury earthquakes and once for COVID, of course. And what it means is that the government gives itself significant additional powers to deal with emergencies. Now, there's two particular elements that it really brings to the fore. The first is that it gives a lot of power to the Director of Civil Defence, or if they decide to appoint one, a controller, which is the person who manages the response to disaster. They are now given the ability, using the state of emergency, to direct any aspect of the state's authority to the response. So, and that can happen nationally. So So most obviously that could be things like the armed forces, although their role is actually defined in the Defence Act. But that's they can be required to go and assist. But it could be anything from any department can be asked to do particular things that will assist with the recovery. And there are quite a broad range of powers that the director has in relation to that. And then alongside that, there's powers that actually apply at local emergency, during local states of emergency as well. And they're pretty draconian, they're pretty extensive. And a lot of them apply, for example, to the police. The police can, or anybody that the director instructs can force or require somebody to do anything to assist in the response, or alternatively to stop doing something that was stopping the response. So that's a pretty broad power. It also has powers like to enter into vehicles, to move vehicles, to close roads, to requisition vehicles. So all those sort of powers apply. But those actually did apply already in the local state of emergency. Now they're just coordinated at the national level, but they only apply in the areas that the state of emergency has been declared. So in the north part of the North Island.
So how long would you expect Aotearoa to be in a national state of emergency because of the cyclone?
That's a really good question. So the way the law works is that it's always for portions of a week. So when the state of emergency is declared, it lasts for a week, unless it's ended earlier. It obviously won't end before the week is out. So it'll be a week. And then in a week's time, almost certainly, it'll be renewed again. And if you look into the government's announcements, you'll notice that every week there will be another announcement stating that the emergency has been extended. So I think it likely will extend for a while. But I think it does raise an issue, because what's happened both in Canterbury and in COVID, the examples that happened previously, the government wanted to continue to use emergency powers but didn't like having to declare emergencies every week. It doesn't look good. Politically, if a country's in a state of emergency, it can be bad on the international stage and so on. So what they did in both those cases was pass new laws, which in effect gave emergency powers for much, much longer periods of time. In the case of Canterbury, it was for a further 6 years. So we'll see what happens in this case.
Given climate change and the recent extreme weather events, can we anticipate this response being utilised more often in the future?
I think that's highly likely. And the one thing you'll probably noticed in the media, people keep talking about this being a natural disaster, and there's been talking about things beyond our imagination and so on. To be quite frank, it's not. It was predicted that these sort of events will occur. In fact, events like this do happen, as we know in New Zealand. All the climate models suggest that they will become, that storms will become stronger. So these sort of storms will reach New Zealand shores more regularly. On the basis of that, we're going to need these powers again. But the message I would put out is, rather than thinking about having these powers, which yes, we need, and there's lots of, we can discuss them if you want, but actually we need to prepare better so that we don't need so much of a response. So many of the things that have occurred, some of them, of course, it's very difficult to prepare for the level of water. But you can build infrastructure that's more resilient. You can make sure houses are built in better places. You can make sure people are more prepared and given instructions and so on what to do. And we haven't done enough of this, and we need to do more if we want to stop the hazard of a storm like this turning into the disaster that it's obviously become.
That was Canterbury University Professor John Hopkins on what the current national state of emergency means for Aotearoa.
That was The Green Desk on 95 BFM.
That was The Wire.
Ko-ira te hotaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, ne te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki o mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Wednesday Wire. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today. And next up is the 1-4 with Bridge.
That was a 95 BFM podcast. Support 95 BFM with a B card. Go to 95bfm.com/signup.